every October, my friends were thoroughly annoyed with me as I was growing up. And to understand why, you have to understand that I loved haunted houses. I always loved a good spooky story or the adventure that awaited whenever I walked through the dark, twisty maze of a haunted house, waiting for the next creepy surprise to jump out at me. But most of my friends were probably pretty annoyed with me because I would insist on going to the haunted house and that they should come with me. And then as we walked through, even if I was scared, I laughed the whole way through. They would scream, they would jump, I just laughed. I likely found some of it, including sometimes their reactions, funny. But it wasn't only that I found it funny, I also laughed out of fear. The kind of nervous laughter that gets you through an awkward moment. At times, I likely laughed also because I thought that it was silly that I was afraid at all. Because I knew that nothing in the haunted house could hurt me. All of the people were actors, actors who weren't even allowed to touch anyone who was going through the haunted house. And just knowing that gave me the ability to control my fear, to keep it at arm's reach, rather than the other way around. Yet there are times in our lives when that is not the case, when fear has control over us, and we are not able to control it. Or if not fear, another force that has the power to control us, sometimes even seeking to destroy us. Much like for the man who was living among the tombs and the townspeople in today's story from Mark. They came to the other side of the sea, to the country of the Gerasenes, Mark tells us. And when he had stepped out of the boat, immediately a man out of the tombs with an unclean spirit met him. He lived among the tombs, and no one could restrain him anymore, even with a chain, for he had often been restrained with chains and shackles, but the chains he wrenched apart and the shackles he broke into pieces, and no one had the strength to subdue him. Night and day, among the tombs and on the mountains, he was always howling and bruising himself with stones. It's clear from the description that this is a man who is consumed by a power other than himself. Not only has this power, this demon, consumed him, it also seeks to destroy him. It separates him from his community and causes him to harm himself. He lives alone among the tombs, bound not just by chains and shackles, but also by the people in the nearby town, his community, his friends, who are fearful of what he may do. And it's tempting to believe that the man with the demonic spirit is the one controlled by the power. He's the only one. But I think that ignores that the townspeople seem to be controlled by their fear. Fear that causes them to first cast him out of the community, separating him from any real human connection. Connection that's not only desired, but needed. And then when the fear is too much, fear that he might wander back into town, they then restrain him with shackles and chains. They're caught in a cyclone of terror, all of them. The man has been swept up by the demonic spirit while the townspeople have been caught up in their fear. Cyclones that threaten to consume them and us. Some of us battle demons on a daily basis. Addiction, depression, anxiety. And still for others of us, we're consumed by our fear of losing what we have, fear of losing our power, or maybe fear of losing safety. Some of us fear death. And this is where Jesus meets us, Mark reminds us. He walks into our fear and into our terror. Before we go any further, I need to make something clear. Where we find Jesus in this morning's story is among the last places that one would have expected to find him. He's out on the margins, crossing not only lines of faith traditions, but also racial lines. He's a Jewish man in a Gentile land. Furthermore, no one would expect him to be at the tombs in order to meet our possessed man, something that would have made him unclean. But this is where we find Jesus, in the midst of the terror, and on the margins where there are people in need. And then he engages with the tortured men. When he saw Jesus from a distance, he ran and bowed before him, and he shouted at the top of his voice, "What have you to do with me, Jesus, Son of the Most High God? I adjure you by God, do not torment me." For he had said to him, "Come out of the man, you unclean spirit." Then Jesus asked, "What is your name?" He replied, "My name is Legion, for we are many." Jesus wanders into the terror and elicits the name of the demon. He identifies it. There is power in naming something, the power to identify, and in that identification, then to be able to respond and to do something. Naming something, putting an identity to it, almost always gives us a certain amount of control that we may not have had before. I was able to ID the actors and the props in the haunted house as a facsimile, which allowed me to hold on to my fear in a very real way, very particular way. People who are able to identify and name the particular cancer, mental illness, or chronic health condition they are diagnosed with give them the power to form treatment plans in ways that they weren't able to before. Grieving people who can name why it is that they are feeling something are better able to move within and through their grief instead of getting stuck. And once an addict puts a name to their addiction, it's the first step in being able to fight that addiction. Names have power, which makes me wonder, is there any power that torments you now? Is it something socially acceptable like perfectionism or workaholism, so we don't believe it to be a problem? Or is it something that we know to be an issue like chronic anxiety, depression, or addiction? And what is its name? Whatever you name it, or even if you can't name it, Jesus already knows what it is. He's wandered into the tombs of your life to free you from whatever power torments you. He does not leave us to the powers that seek to destroy us. Instead, he seeks to free you from whatever it is that you just named. And sometimes he does this by saving others around you. I suspect that is what happened when after Jesus healed the man who was consumed by the demonic spirit. He sent him away saying, "Return to your home and declare how much the Lord has done for you." So he went away proclaiming throughout the city what Jesus had done for him. I suspect that the reason Jesus sends the man back to the community is to save them, to save the community, to set them free, to show them what God has done, what God can do. Death in all of its forms is about separation. It doesn't know what to do with reunion. And by the man obeying Jesus' command to go back to his friends, to join them once again, despite having to face the stares, the pointing, and even the snide comments behind his back, it chips away at death's presence in their community. By reuniting them, life begins to take over little by little. And the powers that defy God, death is pushed out. Because life is always more powerful than death. It calls us out of the shadows and brings us into the light. It breaks down the walls that we put up and casts the fear that we carry with us away. It opens us up for more, able to enjoy each other in ways that we simply could not when we were so familiar with death and that was all that we saw. Life is about unification. And Jesus repeatedly shows up, breaking the bonds of death in our lives, giving us life, frequently saving us by saving someone else, giving us others to walk with through the shadows of our life, to be little glimpses of freedom and life when all we see is captivity and death. Because life is contagious, and it cannot be swallowed by death. Life born out of our God's refusal to be separated from the children of the family, even being willing to enter into death so that there will be life.